It was very unusual. You know, there's very little video footage that has come out of from prisons around the country, despite there being a number of surveillance cameras. You know, like Dr. Venter said, the truth is hidden. It's intentionally hidden. It's very difficult. You know, reporting on what's going inside of jails and prisons is very difficult. But obviously, the more journalists who are taking on the challenge, the more we're going to get to the heart of what the truth is.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Homer Venters, former chief medical officer for New York City's Correctional Health Services. His new book, Life and Death in Rikers Island. And Jennifer Gonerman, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, will link to her piece, Do Jails Kill People? And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tay Marie Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gudars, and Karl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krogh-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. If you'd like to see our video and audio podcasts, read the transcripts, go to democracynow.org. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, text the word Democracy Now! To 66866. I'm Amy Goodman.
Roasting 200 years of corporate constitutional rights, 1819 to 2019, notes the anniversary of the first U.S. Supreme Court decision granting constitutional rights to business corporations. The event features a photography exhibit, trivia, conversation, and presentations about how we can reclaim people's constitutional rights and dismantle corporate rights. Again, that's Roasting 200 Years of Corporate Constitutional Rights on Thursday, February 28th from 6 to 9 p.m. This is a drop-in event happening at the Just Bob Cafe, 2403 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. Most films will show at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, now through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Oregon lawmakers have been demoted for making sexist comments.
The House of Representatives votes on a resolution to prevent Trump's border wall.
And in international news, U.S. efforts to overthrow the Venezuelan president are hitting snags for now. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 26, 2019.
I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Last week, Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek demoted two lawmakers for making sexist comments in public. Longtime Representative Mitch Greenlich was kicked out of his position as chairman of the House Committee on Healthcare and was also removed from the House Conduct Committee. Kotek said Greenlich made, quote, demeaning comments towards two individuals who were testifying before his committee. The speaker also took Republican Representative Bill Post of Salem off the House Committee on Judiciary. Kotek fired Post for tweets he made about a member of the Senate and another regarding an upcoming lobby day inviting gun roots groups to a gun control rally with the words, quote, be ready, be there.
Earlier today, the U.S. House of Representatives voted on a resolution to override Donald Trump's declaration of emergency at the southern border. Trump's emergency declaration is seen by many as a bypass around Congress's refusal to allocate funds for a border wall. Republicans worry that if this declaration is allowed, that future presidents can use it as justification for their own emergency declarations, which could focus on issues such as gun control or health care. The House passed the bill to block the emergency declaration with a vote of 245 to 182, with five representatives not voting. All Democratic representatives voted to block the emergency declaration, and they were joined by 13 Republicans. According to the National Emergencies Act, the Senate must vote on the resolution within 18 days after its passage in the House. The White House has already said the president will veto the legislation if it comes to his desk.
A group of 58 former national security officials have joined the chorus against Donald Trump's emergency proclamation to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. The bipartisan group includes former diplomats, intelligence chiefs, cabinet secretaries, and senior officials from several previous administrations. Their 13-page joint statement says that they are aware of no situation that justifies the call for emergency action that the president made on February 15th. The statement was entered into the congressional record yesterday in advance of today's House vote on legislation that would reverse the Trump order. Among the signers were former Secretaries of State Madeleine Albright and John Kerry, as well as past Secretaries of Defense Chuck Hagel and Leon Panetta. The advocacy groups Public Citizen and Citizens Responsibility and Ethics have also filed suit.
U.S. government attempts to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro took several hits this weekend as politically motivated aid shipments were rejected from multiple entry points and several world governments threw water on U.S. desires to invade militarily. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence joined coup leaders Senator Marco Rubio and self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido in Colombia on Monday for a meeting with the U.S.-friendly Lima Group, where many U.S.-friendly Latin American countries rejected U.S. desires to invade. Former colonizer Spain, who along with many EU nation states, has backed the coup. They also issued a strong statement rejecting U.S.-led military intervention. Spain's statement was followed by an anti-invasion statement from the EU, followed by news that Brazil, led by fascist Jair Bolsonaro, has lost its internal consensus, meaning the Brazil military will not comply with military action on its neighbor. Pence, a democracy-loving Koch brothers Republican, responded to this latest failure by again shouting Trump's position that military options are on the table. In Grand Mafia style, Pence also announced new U.S. sanctions on four democratically elected Venezuelan governors of border and port states as apparent punishment for their refusal to participate in aiding a foreign power in overthrowing their country's government.
Tensions between Pakistan and India, both nuclear powers, rose considerably today following a morning airstrike by the Indian Army. The strike occurred in a forested region of northern Pakistan and was the first of its nature in 50 years. The attack comes at the tail end of a year of nationalist rousing under Prime Minister Modi. At a rally held in New Delhi, Modi seemed to declare the airstrike as an act of vengeance for a militant attack which occurred in the contested region of Kashmir, in which dozens of Indian soldiers were killed. Prime Minister Imran Khan of Pakistan claimed the strikes were carried out for domestic consumption in India, as Modi prepares for national elections. Prime Minister Khan, in a statement, promised retribution for the airstrike.
The Portland State University community wants campus police officers to not carry guns. That's according to a report released last week. Outcry against armed university police started before the university created its police department. More voices have risen in protest since last year's fatal shooting in June, when PSU officers killed a Good Samaritan who had tried to stop a fight at the Cheerful Tortoise, an off-campus sports bar. The victim, Jason Washington, had a legal permit for a concealed weapon, but he was killed by police after his gun fell from its holster. The PSU report surveyed students, faculty, and staff, finding 52% favored disarming campus police, 37% wanted officers to keep their guns, and 10% did not have an opinion on the matter. More than 4,000 people responded to the survey, out of almost 28,000 students, staff, and faculty. Despite the majority support for disarming officers, the report suggests that the university keep its armed force intact. Tune in to the totality of circumstances at 5:30 for more on this story.
Since 2016, San Francisco Bay Area activists have been objecting to Urban Shield, the nation's largest Homeland Security-funded weapons expo and counterterrorism drill. Over the last 5 years, Oakland kicked it out of the city, and dozens of people were arrested protesting around its perimeter. The Alameda County Board of Supervisors convened a task force to consider the community's objections and passed two different resolutions to rein in the event's abuses. Earlier today, the board met to consider task force recommendations to change the event from a SWAT-focused police militarization convention to a natural disaster-focused community recovery and resilience event. Pacifica Radio's Ann Garrison has this story.
Tracy, if the board accepts the task force recommendations, what will change?
If the board accepts all of the recommendations, and there are quite a few of them, the biggest changes would be, first, an end to the Weapons Expo, which funneled the latest and greatest military-style hardware to local police departments. Second, an end to the SWAT drills in favor of more fire, more public health, and less violent scenarios that are not scored competitively. Last, redirecting millions of dollars of federal emergency preparedness funds away from counterterrorism and towards public health and social services.
How likely is it that the board will accept the recommendations?
The board passed a resolution in the spring of 2018, authored by a Berkeley rep, Keith Carson, to end Urban Shield as currently constituted. I don't think anyone knows exactly what that means. What we do know is that the sheriff's department has been working hard with posts all over the software program Nextdoor, for example, to preserve Urban Shield with just a few cosmetic changes. The event has a long history of racist stereotyping and reinforcing the excessive use of force, so this is an important moment in local criminal justice reform.
How can Alameda County residents help?
If your schedule permits, come to the meeting on the 26th at the Alameda County Building at 1221 Oak Street in Oakland. If not, write to the Board of Supervisors this weekend. You can find an email action on our website at www.media-alliance.org. That will make it easy. Or you can call your supervisor and leave a message on their voicemail this weekend. Urban Shield trains police departments all over the area, so this isn't just an Alameda County issue. It affects all of us.
And that was Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of Media Alliance. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KBFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
An Oregon state trooper is suing his employer, alleging his supervisor mocked his efforts to file for workers' compensation for injuries suffered on the job and called him a homophobic slur. The lawsuit says longtime state trooper Mark McDougall sought medical care for repeated injuries suffered on the job, including a spinal injury when he was run over by a suspect's car. The suit says that injury was made worse when McDougall tried cardiopulmonary resuscitation on a suspect who had been shot by a member of the Basin Interagency Narcotics Enforcement Team. The shooting victim died. The trooper also injured his shoulder during training, which required surgery. Then earlier this month, he suffered a concussion on the job after falling on snow and ice in the parking lot and striking his head on a patrol car's bumper. The lawsuit says the trooper's supervisor mocked McDougall for his injuries, called him names, and made derogatory remarks about McDougall's genitals when the trooper filed workers' compensation claims. The lawsuit is one of several brought last year against the same supervisor by six other troopers in the Klamath Falls Area Command Office.
The discovery of regular text messaging between the Portland Police Bureau and the leader of Vancouver-based Patriots Prayer has alarmed many in the community. Not surprisingly, the story led to a very defensive response from Portland's police unions. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
In the wake of the revelations of extensive text communications between the Portland Police Bureau and Joey Gibson, the leader of the alt-right group Patriots Prayer, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and Commissioner Chloe Udaly called for an independent investigation to, quote, review the existence of bias in the actions of the Portland Police Bureau leading up to and during demonstrations involving alt-right and anti-fascist protesters, end quote. This is the right thing to do. Do the text messages between Portland Police Lieutenant Jeff Nye demonstrate complicity between the PPB and Gibson? Or are they, as Lieutenant Nye claims, just an example of the kinds of regular communications he had with groups on both the left and the right in order to minimize the potential for conflict at planned protests? The underlying question is, are they yet another illustration of the cultural bias that many accuse the Portland police of having, or are they just an example of a cop trying to do his job? We need to be able to put this in context, and only an independent investigation will allow us to do that. But to me, one of the most disappointing aspects of the whole thing has been the response of Portland's police unions. Last Tuesday, the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association filed workplace complaints against Wheeler, Hardesty, and Udaly, claiming that they violated a rule that prohibits, quote, workplace harassment, discrimination, and retaliation, end quote. And on Thursday, Darrell Turner, the president of the Portland Police Association, demanded an apology from Commissioner Udaly, who had the temerity to question the Commanding Officer Association's definition of, quote, basic police work, end quote. This is the same Darrell Turner who was quoted last July as saying that Portland had turned into a cesspool in response to Wheeler's questioning of the fact that 52% of the arrests in 2017 were of homeless people, a group that represents less than 3% of the city's population. This is the same union that filed a grievance when the city fired Sergeant Greg Lewis for making flagrantly racist remarks during roll call. That grievance and a desire to avoid a costly arbitration resulted in the city paying Lewis a $100,000 settlement and allowing him to retire. I am pro-labor and pro-union, but I am also in favor of accountability. This is especially true when the individual or organization is funded by taxpayers, as the Portland Police Bureau is. The police union's over-the-top response to the city council's legitimate request for an independent investigation is alarming and will only exacerbate the already existing tension between the police bureau and a large percentage of the community that they are supposed to be protecting and serving. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker speaking with members of the Portland State University Student Union about their work on the Disarm PSU campaign. Then at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with late night snow showers and a low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with light AM snow showers and a high of 40 degrees. Today in history. In 2012, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin is shot and killed by George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida. Following his death, rallies, marches, and protests were held across the nation. More than 1,000 people attended the viewing of his remains in Miami. Zimmerman claimed self-defense and was acquitted of the second-degree murder charges against him. In 2017, Martin's parents published a book about his life and death titled Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. The quote of the day is from former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who said, quote, "Where you see wrong or inequality or injustice, speak out, because this is your country. This is your democracy. Make it, protect it, pass it on."
Last week, the Supreme Court came to a unanimous decision regarding the issue of civil asset forfeiture. This is the practice of government or police officials seizing property which might have been used in a crime, with the suspicion of use in a crime being the only proof. Anything can be taken that is suspected of use in a crime, including cash, homes, heirlooms, or vehicles. The majority of items taken are never returned nor reimbursed for their value, even when there is no conviction of a crime. Speaking for all 9 unanimous justices, Justice Ginsburg wrote, quote, "The historical and logical case for concluding that the 14th Amendment incorporates the excessive fines clause is overwhelming. Exorbitant tolls undermine other constitutional liberties." Ginsburg also reiterated and expounded upon an earlier decision that even without a political motive, quote, "fines may be employed in a measure out of accord with the penal goals of retribution, and deterrence for fines are a source of revenue, while other forms of punishment cost the state money."
AT&T, the titanic $200 billion telecommunications corporation, will be allowed to buy Time Warner Communications for $85 billion as a result of a federal appeals court ruling today. The ruling is a major slap to federal regulator Makan Dhanarim, who took on the Trump administration's pro-corporate policies in an attempt to hold the giant corporations to the rule of law, specifically the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. A 3-judge panel rejected Dhanarim's assertion that the merger would allow AT&T to crush competitors by wielding AT&T's massive distribution network to pump Time Warner's ownership of creative content. The conceit employed since the Reagan administration's 1980s conservative court packing is that the Sherman Antitrust Act need not apply to even the hugest and most monopolizing mergers if the parties involved can show that the efficiency gained by the elimination of duplication in the merger will result in better prices for the public. Of course, prices are set under capitalism by supply and demand, so the only real and lasting change of monetary dynamics under a large merger is the increase of profits for the stockholders. Citing the Washington Post, the court said, quote, "The government failed to prove its claims that the lower court had misapplied fundamental principles of economics when assessing the deal's potential impact on consumers and AT&T's rivals. The price effects of that fundamental principle, supply and demand, are not normally considered in question outside the rarefied echelons of politically appointed superior courts." AT&T, satisfied with the decision, issued a statement indicating their desire that the matter not be pursued further to the Supreme Court.
Microsoft employees have begun circulating an internal document opposing the inclusion of certain technologies which they helped develop for an Army contract. The concerned employees suggest that the Army and other military branches would ostensibly use the HoloLens and other technologies for war purposes. This would turn the reality of battle into a virtual game for soldiers and help to further disassociate the soldiers from the real horrors of war. The workers said, quote, "We did not sign up to develop weapons, and we demand a say in how our work is used."
Moderates in the California Republican Party are breathing a sigh of relief after political consultant Jessica Patterson was elected as the new chair yesterday. Lily Jamali and Katie Orr have more from the California Report.
Well, moderates in the California Republican Party are breathing a sigh of relief after political consultant Jessica Patterson was elected as their new chair. KQED Politics and Government reporter Katie Orr was at the party convention and filed this report.
State Republicans went into their convention facing a choice. Would they elect a more moderate chair or double down on a conservative leader? Before the vote, the convention crowd was tense, the race considered close. But within minutes, the results became clear. Patterson, the choice of many party moderates, was elected with nearly 55% of the vote. In her acceptance speech, Patterson said she has one main goal.
Winning. We're going to take the fight to Democrats. We're going to fight them in the press, at community gatherings, and we're going to fight them in the precincts. And we're going to beat them in elections.
Patterson will be the first woman to serve in the role. She takes over a party with declining registration numbers and a slew of recent election losses. But she says she's ready to deliver a Republican comeback in the state. For the California Report, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
Around 800 workers at Providence Portland Medical Center in Northeast Portland have voted to unionize with the Service Employees International Union Local 49. SEIU organizers say hospitals have profited over the Medicaid expansion, which reduced the amount of uncompensated services provided to low-income patients. The union argues that profit should go to the workers instead of executive salaries. The union vote was held in December of last year, but the results were not complete until February 22nd. The newly unionized workers include emergency room technicians, certified nursing assistants, and janitorial staff. The successful election comes the year after the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Janus v. AFSCME case, which resulted in the decision that public employees whose jobs are unionized but who do not want to belong to the union no longer have to pay dues.
A statewide rent control and no-cause eviction bill has advanced to the governor's desk. It is the first in the nation. Bill 608, the legislature's response to homelessness, passed the Oregon Senate today, prohibiting no-cause evictions after 12 months. It also allows a 7% cap on rental increases, according to the Oregon legislature overview. There are many rules, exclusions, and fine print. Critics of the bill say that it will be best protect current renters, while leaving new renters with higher rental rates and reducing options for increasing the availability of housing.
Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum backed a proposal yesterday to regulate student loan services and force them to be licensed under the state. It would also create a student loan ombudsperson to help borrowers navigate a complex loan process. Rosenblum says at least 58% of college students in Oregon graduate with debt, and the state's outstanding student loan debt has surpassed $18 billion. Oregon is joining a growing movement among states to protect those who take out student loans, introducing legislation that would crack down on student loan services like Navient and Nelnet. The proposal is based on Connecticut's so-called Student Loan Bill of Rights, which has been picked up by other state legislatures across the country. At least four states, plus the District of Columbia, have passed similar laws aimed at regulating servicers. Student loan companies have previously come under fire for allegedly misleading borrowers into accepting unnecessary and costly repayment plans.
A lawsuit has been filed against Trailhead Marketing, located in Northeast Portland, by former employee Lydia Gronendijk. The lawsuit alleges that her boss, the CEO of the company, was discriminatory towards her in how he handled a, quote, menstruation accident that occurred at work. According to the lawsuit, Gronendijk alleges that Trailhead Marketing violated Oregon's laws for harassment and discrimination based on sex when the CEO sent her text messages asking her why she was not prepared and to, quote, go to Fred's and buy new panties and tampons.
Next month, Legacy Health Group in Vancouver will be holding four clinics offering free vaccinations for measles, mumps, and rubella. This comes in response to the 65 confirmed measles cases in Clark County. Of those 65 cases, 57 were unvaccinated and two had only received one dose of the vaccine. Recently, the outbreak has moved into Oregon, where four cases have been identified by health officials in Multnomah County. Those eligible for vaccinations are children 1 year or older who have not been vaccinated, children 4 years or older who have not received their second dose, and adults under 63 who are not vaccinated and are uncertain if they have had measles in the past. No insurance is required to receive vaccinations at these clinics. The free clinics will be held on Friday, March 1st, Friday the 8th, Friday the 15th, and Friday the 22nd at the Legacy Group Family Wellness Center. For any questions, call Legacy Health Group at 503-413-3083.
Today marks the 7th anniversary of the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin at the hands of Community Watch member George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida. Martin was walking back to his father's fiancée's home from a local convenience store when Zimmerman spotted him and called the police. Moments later, Zimmerman fatally shot Martin in the chest. Zimmerman claimed that he was defending himself. Shielded by Florida's so-called Stand Your Ground law, police were unable to arrest or charge him at the time. It was only after widespread media coverage that Zimmerman was eventually arrested and charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. However, a jury acquitted him in July of 2013. After Martin's death, marches and rallies were held nationwide to demand justice and a full investigation into the events of that evening. Martin's murder also sparked a national debate over racial profiling and Stand Your Ground laws.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, February 26, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Carissa Bahush, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Emily Gresham-Beamer, Al Kahn, Leslie McLam, and Emery Mort. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up in this morning on KABU, at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, the radio activist Lisa Loving and Suzanne LeGrand interview Dara Snyder of the YMCA and Simab Hosani of Unite Oregon and CAIR Oregon. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's a special presentation of author Rima Zaman's recent reading at Powell's Books of her latest memoir, I Am Yours. All of this KABU programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kabu.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
It's time for Totality of Circumstance. We're going straight to you.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. My name is Sam Bowman.
I'm Jasmine.
And you are listening to Totality of Circumstances. We're a segment of the KABU Evening News that airs every Tuesday from 5:30 to 6. We're focused on policing, specifically the community response to policing, community knowledge around policing, and community solutions. And we are joined in the studio today by members of the Portland State University Student Union, and we will introduce ourselves all in a minute. We just want to go through some things that have happened over the past week, right quick. I think just a couple days after our last show was the listening, or perhaps hands over the ears session that the PPB held at Maranatha Church up on just off of Prescott and 12th. And that was about the text messages between Lieutenant Jeff Nia and Patriot Prayer's Joey Gibson. And I think there's, if you don't know about it already, there are a lot of news coverage out there. The Mercury and the Willamette Week both had a roundup of what happened. But we were both there. Were any of you there as well?
Yeah, I was there.
And what did you think of it?
It was a mess.
Yeah, a lot of, one thing I was thinking was that it might help if they were serious about their mission to break it up into smaller groups for the next several months or something, because that was, I kind of experienced it as a bit of a kind of set up to fail sort of situation. I mean, you get, but there are a lot of ways that you could take that event that happened. I mean, some might even think of it as a success. A lot was said to the police brass, and I believe there's a lot of video of it on YouTube as well. And I would recommend that people, if you aren't aware of what happened, to check out some of the things that people said. We can't go through all of it tonight, unfortunately, so we're probably just not going to broach too much of the topic. But the big news that we want to discuss is that the long-awaited report, long-awaited for various reasons, came out regarding the arming of the Portland State University Campus Public Safety Office, which happened back in 2015 and eventually resulted in the death, the killing of Jason Washington by Portland State University Campus Public Safety officers. And the report was commissioned by the university. They got a consultant called Margulis Healy. That's the group's name. And they turned out a, 200-and-something page report just a few days ago. And that's probably a good a time as any to introduce. Did I miss anything, Jasmine, news-wise? Okay. That's a good time enough to introduce the members of the Portland State University Student Union. Thank you all so much for being here today. If you want to start to my right here.
My name is Mason Mimi Adida, and my pronouns are they, them, and I'm a member of the Student Union.
Hi, my name is Caitlin. I am also a member of the PSC Student Union.
Hi, my name is Alexander, and I'm also a member of SUSU.
All right, and so SUSU, that's PSUSU for mm-hmm. the folks following along at home, and we have kind of a loose policy of always spelling out acronyms, so if I interrupt you and ask you to explain anything at any point, that's why. So can you just tell me a little bit briefly what is SUSU? How did and I guess what I'm curious, it's a very active student union in activism on campus and in specifically around this disarming the PSU police issue. Can you just tell me a little bit about the union itself and how you got involved in it?
So the student union has been around now for roughly 6 or 7 years on PSU's campus, and it actually, one of the first campaigns that the student union ever had was called Demilitarize PSU, which was a few years before the campus security were armed. So that's always kind of been one of like the grounding forces of the student union's work. We also do a lot of work around tuition. Specifically, we aim for tuition to be abolished. But every year we see the Board of Trustees, who are the same people who voted to arm campus security, they also every year vote to raise tuition. And so those are kind of the primary thrusts of a lot of the work that we do. We also try to like support a lot of other campaigns that are going on, especially with faculty and staff, and connecting to community work that's going on. I don't know if one of you want to talk more about Disarm.
Yeah, so the PSU Student Union, something to clarify about us is we're an autonomous student union, and so we're very intentional with how we operate. We don't operate within the university. There's this thing called SALP, which stands for the Student Activities and Leaderships Programs. We are not recognized by SALP, and we just do things outside the university. And that has to do with a lot of reasons. We don't feel that the university is a proper avenue to advocate through, and we also know that a lot of the things we do would make us lose our membership with SALP anyways. So that's a little bit about SUSU and the Disarm PSU campaign. Going off of what Mason was saying earlier, It came after the demilitarized PSU campaign, and it was in response to PSU Board of Trustees going ahead with the decision to arm campus security officers and create a fully fledged sworn police force on campus, despite students and faculty saying that we don't want this. So the campaign started in the summer of 2015. July 1st was when the first three officers were armed. Now we have about 10 officers, I think. It's hard to say because a lot of people, lots of shuffling with staffing right now, but about 10 officers now. And the campaign is really just asking that we get rid of the police force on campus. That includes getting rid of their guns, but also taking away any policing powers they have.
Yeah, and I'll just add that SUSU does like a variety of campaigns. Like Mason mentioned, we've worked with faculty back when we were starting. A lot of our work was around helping AAUP, the Union for the University Professors, organize their strike. And then recently, last year, we did Students Against Sexual Violence is what the campaign is called, basically. Trying to get the university to uphold its Title IX requirements. And then our two biggest ones, especially going into this year, are the Disarm PSU campaign and our tuition campaign.
And I wanted to ask, were any of you at PSU when the arming decision was happening?
Yeah, me and Caitlin both were. I started.
Well, to clarify, I came like right after it happened, like a few months after. Yeah. You, I think, were the only one, Mason.
Okay. I started at PSU in 2014 and had right away joined the student union because of the demilitarized PSU campaign, actually. I was walking on campus and I saw people in the student union tabling for it. And I was like, what is this? Like, and it was a really wild time because that was the year when there was a lot of like really intense actions happening. Because it was the fall of 2014 leading into 2015 up until they voted, because they had two different votes to arm, actually. One of them was the night when Darren Wilson was not indicted, and so there was so much pushback to that that they then postponed the actual vote, and they voted for real in the spring. And so then they still voted yes, I think with there was like two people on the board who voted no out of 14 voting members. And then the rollout started in the summer, or in July of 2015.
Yeah, because that was around the time I came in. One of the big actions SUSU did to kick off the Disarm PSU campaign, and this is also how I got involved with SUSU, was every year there's a president's convocation, which is the welcoming to new students. And SUSU disrupted that meeting and did a mic check and said, university officers are armed, this is against the will of students, and told all the students there to walk out and join the rally that was happening. And there was a rally that happened outside. And that was kind of the launch of this campaign that now has just grown so much in the past 3 years.
Did you want to add anything?
No, I wasn't there at the time.
Oh. And so let's just a good, it sometimes helps to just simplify things a bit, but why disarm PSU? Like in your words, why shouldn't the campus public safety officers be armed?
I think, so a lot of the reasons we say disarm PSU is because we recognize the violence of policing. In SUSU, I can confidently say all of us are abolitionist and believe that the prison industrial complex should be abolished. And so that's a lot of where our motivation goes as we launch this campaign. And so we point to both the violence of policing, but also how policing is used to control public space. So for instance, at PSU, there are a lot of houseless people who come on campus to have a safe place to stay. And it is a public campus, so they have every right to be there. But PSU police are used to sweep people off of campus who may be charging their phone or sleeping on the couches. So it's a way to control public space, and we don't believe that to be right.
And I would say too, yeah, with the armament came a lot more power, like not just because of the guns, but because they became a fully like trained or like fully, I forget what the word, I'm trying to think of the
sworn,
right word.
Sworn, usually.
Yeah, that's the right word. Like a fully sworn police force. And so they have more power to do things like that and to kind of control all the public space on campus and to also do those things with impunity, like to harm people with impunity. And so I think that the biggest rally call was around disarmament. I think because that's kind of one of the most tangible things and like slogan-y things, you know, to kind of encapsulate what we're trying to get at, but it's much broader than just the guns.
Yeah, I really think the guns, because they don't really use them very much. They're mostly there for intimidation. They do, just them having it increases their violence. And yeah, I would echo what both of them they have said about it really just being a means to control the populations that are there. The university and the board of trustees has like a big interest in making the campus look appealing, look nice, so they get rid of all the houses people that have lived in that community for a long time. It looks better to investors. It looks better to students that are coming in. So that's really one of the main purposes behind it.
Okay, and so like the two big events that have brought a lot of attention to the Disarm PSU event. I mean, the big one is the killing of Jason Washington back in June of last year, outside of the Cheerful Tortoise, and but another one would be the so-called in custody death of Richard Berry. And can you, so I was, part of the reason that we were interested in having Susu on is I was at the Care Not Cops event recently at the Dismantle Change Build Center, formerly In Other Words in North Portland, north, barely northeast, I think.
Yeah.
There was, I noticed that the student union representatives had a lot of knowledge about this event, and I was wondering if you could tell us how that was, how do you find out about something like that on campus that happened because of the campus public safety officers? Like, what was the experience of that event for students and the PSU community, the Richard Berry one in particular?
Yeah, that one really could easily have gone under the radar, and was the school made no like effort to kind of talk about it. I mean, mostly I think we found out those ones just through media reports of it, and even the media seemed confused, and the information there wasn't there, because first we knew that there had been a death. We didn't know if it was PPB that was involved or CPSO. There were conflicting reports about whether it happened on the way to the before the paramedics came, while he was on the way to the hospital, or after the hospital. And the school didn't release any kind of statement or anything about that for a long time. I think when it finally did, it was really inadequate. What they actually wrote was just like, yeah, this death happened, like, sorry, pretty much is their response.
And could you actually just tell us briefly what happened with that event? Or just for our listeners, I do feel like it's kind of an unfamiliar story among some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was over the week of Thanksgiving. I don't remember. Was it on Thanksgiving itself?
Yeah, it was either Thanksgiving or the day after, or like that night or something.
Yeah, right about then, I believe it was CPSO that was called to perform a mental health check on this person, Richard Berry, who had been on campus that morning. And like I said, the media coverage of it is, there's not a lot of information out there, but it seems that there was a some kind of a violent interaction with CPSO. They had some kind of like coming together. I'm not sure exactly what.
Yeah, they called it an altercation.
Yeah, altercation. Yeah.
But didn't give
for.
Us details of what the altercation was. Basically, they just said there was an altercation that happened, and then afterwards, Richard Berry ended up going to the hospital, and somewhere in between that time he died. And then later reports said that he died from a drug overdose, but after that they kind of didn't give us any more details.
And so we got 10 or so minutes left, and I do want to talk a little bit about the Margulis Healy report that came out. But before we actually talk about the contents of it, the existence of it itself is controversial, I feel. Like, what were some of the reactions to having this group come in and perform this review?
We were definitely not happy about it. We had some people who are kind of friends of Susu who did a lot of research into Margulis Healy and ended up making a zine that just gave all this background of who Margulis Healy was. And really the gist of it is it's an organization that's made up mostly of former law enforcement, in particular law enforcement from public universities. And so in that sense, they are experts on the issue, and that's why they created this consulting firm. And this is what they consult on, is campus public safety at different universities. Ours was a very unique situation because normally they respond to Title IX complaints. So like if someone was raped on campus and that was handled wrong, normally they would go in and give a consultation. But for us, we were unique because they said they've never actually given a consultation to a university after university police had killed someone. And so this was brand new territory for them. And they came into our campus and we didn't really know exactly what to expect, but we did expect that they were going to give us a law enforcement answer and their recommendations, as that was their background and we knew that was going to be their bias.
And we should mention that the report itself is, though it was, you know, prompted by the death of Jason Washington, they're not actually investigating that specific incident. That's being done by another group, the OIR group, mm-hmm. which does the mm-hmm. annual reports for the city auditor's office. So you've got these two sort of big violent incidents that have, and especially Jason Washington prompted this report. I know the report only came out a couple days ago, but do you have any immediate sort of reactions to what Margolis Healy had to say? I mean, I was especially, I think one of the biggest sound bites that we've heard, or text bites, is that despite majority opposition to campus police being armed, they still recommend campus police being armed, in part because that keeps them in line with national trends, as though that were an ideal when you talk about the way that policing works in our communities. Mm-hmm. So just sort of, you know, how do you guys feel about what the conclusions that Margolis Healy reached? Is there anything in particular that you think is worth mentioning?
Yeah, I have to say, I was not surprised by the report in the least. I was hopeful they wouldn't say, but I was what they came out with is pretty much what we were expecting. So yeah, I think it's noting it was 52-37 in favor of disarm, and if that was like a ballot measure or something, that'd be a pretty overwhelming majority there. And in terms of what they recommended, I'm not surprised at all that it was we need to spend more money on security. We need to spend more money and do these things, and especially the things they're recommending. They haven't tackled the problem at all. They've recommended increased physical security was what they called it, which is really concerning to us. And that's things like more cameras, more access cards on buildings and stuff. And it's like we can recognize that that's going to be hostile and curtailing the rights of the houses people and the what they call non-affiliates in the report, basically everyone that's not a student on campus. And other recommendations were just more administrative positions to kind of help the campus security because they're not doing a good enough job. And I mean, that's just spending more money on things that aren't going to help. But I will say I was happy to see that there was a decent amount of emphasis on the need for oversight. And what was lacking was that it's student, staff, and faculty oversight. And that's something that us in the student union have really been pushing for, because it's our campus. It's made up of the student, staff, and faculty. And for us not to have the final say on how our community safety is being run, it's not going to work if that's not the case.
Anyone want to add anything else to that?
I can add a little bit. Yeah, that is something that Margolis Healy did kind of get right, is they really focused on, they felt that there was no trust between students and faculty and the administration, which is absolutely true. But their recommendation was to make essentially a campus police force that students and faculty could trust. But I think the point that we're really sticking to as SUSU is that we're never going to have that trust if there's police on campus, and that we want to find alternatives that don't involve police. And the only thing Margolis Healy could provide us was different law enforcement models, because they did look at alternatives. Whereas if we got rid of campus police, what if we contracted with another security firm? What if we made a new contract with the Portland Police Bureau? But we are saying, no, we need to be looking beyond policing and look at alternatives that don't emphasize policing. And so that's something we took issue with. But it was interesting because they did actually show an alternative of what it might look like if PSU were to revert back to how their campus public safety office worked before they created a police force. And so we're going to hopefully build off of that. And Margolis Healy provided like a list of pros and cons. And so we really want to dig into some of the cons of that and try to counter that for the university and really build up a case for that alternative.
So, one, you know, another big thing about the report was this idea that, you know, students and staff and faculty can work together to, you know, for innovative solutions. So as people who have been studying this and who are impacted by this, in your minds, what are some of the non-police solutions that could come to PSU campus?
Well, we've been looking just at models that already exist on campus and how we can build on those and flourish. And so we look at models of like more bystander intervention and de-escalation trainings for all students and faculty on campus to build that knowledge. But also we would love to see like some kind of community self-defense network and just things like that, where really it is peer-led safety efforts and things that don't involve policing.
All right. So we're at about 5 minutes to go here, and I guess we'll do a quick, usually at during the shows, we'll do a community calendar at the end. And if we want to talk a little at the very end about the Disarm PSU Film Festival that's coming up. But if you have anything else to add to this, feel free to chime in.
I think the only other thing to add as far as upcoming events, so in response to the Margulis Healy report, the PSU did make a special board meeting, which is going to happen on March 7th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., I think is the time, and that's going to happen at the Smith Memorial Student Union building in the ballroom, and anyone can go to that. We definitely encourage students, obviously, because those are the voices we think should be in the room the most, but we encourage community members from all across Portland to show up in solidarity.
We also encourage people to maybe check out the PSU Student Union Facebook if you want to see when our general meetings are. Meetings are open to anyone. You don't have to be a student or faculty or staff or anything. But if you want to come be a part of the work that the Student Union is doing, that would be rad.
All right. Thank you guys so much for coming. Sam, Jasmine, we've been talking to Mason, Caitlin, and Alex of the Portland State University Student Union about their efforts to not only disarm police on PDX on the PSU campus, but to remove police and look for other community-based solutions to keep people safe. We're going to jump into the community calendar here. Tonight, as we are going off the air, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP, is having their monthly meeting at Tabor Space on 54th and Belmont. And then tomorrow, the Citizen Review Committee is holding a community dialogue on police crowd control practices from 6 to 8 p.m. at the PSU Smith Memorial Student Union. But there is a Facebook event for that, and you can go on to the Independent Police Review website and find out a little bit more. And then on Thursday, day after tomorrow, the Portland Police Bureau is holding their third and final body cam forum, which is at the PSU Smith Ballroom from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. And then you guys have a film festival coming up. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the film festival is this weekend. It's this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and it's at the Fifth Avenue Cinema, which is on campus. And so this Friday starts at 6:30, and each day it's a mixture of like different short films and some days that have longer films, and there's always going to be some sort of panel or workshop going on. And so this Friday at 6:30, we'll be screening Red Square Revolt and Learning to Resist. And I'm pretty sure that night we have Lisa Bates, who's a faculty at PSU, and then Arresting Power is going to be playing at 8 p.m. that night. And then Saturday starts at 7 p.m., which is more focused on Indigenous movements and Indigenous rights. And we have a lecture called Anti-Indigenous Violence, Settler Imperialism, and Extractive Colonialism in the Americas. And then Sunday starts at 3 p.m., and it starts with a grassroots student organizing workshop that some members of SUSU are going to be leading. And then we have a couple more films. There's a lot of films. So you can check out disarmpsu.com to see what all the films are.
All right. And as you said, we are Sam and Jasmine, and we've been talking with Mason, Caitlin, and Alex of the Portland State University Student Union, or SUSU, with the P is silent. And thank you all so much for coming in today and talking with us. This has been enlightening.
appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to Totality of Circumstances on KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button today.
Listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Right now it's 6 o'clock and Preference is coming up with Hedda. But before we get to the wonderful Preference, we have a few promos for you.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell. What did jazz artists Christian Scott Atunde Adjua, Pharoah Sanders, Steve Turay, Terrence Blanchard, and Marcus Strickland have in common? One, they are all performing at this year's PDX Jazz Festival. And two, they have all been featured on my program, Jazz in the New Millennium. Each one-hour episode focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective. The weekly show is syndicated nationally by